Okay. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Smith, Judge Bjorkman, Judge Hooten, the Honorable Judge Tracy M. Smith presiding.
Thank you. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Our first case on the calendar today, we have five orals. Our first one, which you're here for, is A21-0031, Perry versus Perry. Counsel, each of you has 15 minutes for your principal arguments, and counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. So we are ready to begin. Counsel, when each of you begins your principal argument, if you could identify yourself and the party you represent for the record. Counsel for appellant.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Eric Hansen, and I represent the appellants in this matter, Douglas Perry, Expert Mechanical, Inc., and the estate of Pearl Perry. The issue before the court today is, I would represent a somewhat unique one. What the district court did in this case is something that is not commonly done in Minnesota, and the very little case law that there is on it is an unpublished decision from this court that flatly said an outside reverse Pierce is not Minnesota law. And nevertheless, that's what we have before us, where the district court took a piece of real property from one corporation and purported to move it to a second corporation. And I would hope that it would be helpful for the court. We put a little diagram in our brief right at page 3 to kind of show the relationship between the parties. And if the court looks at that, what you have is Expert Mechanical Corporation was created by Douglas Perry, owning the real property in question, 30 Main is what it's referred to here. And a separate corporation was created jointly, by Douglas and Allison Perry, and that's we've referred to that as Sheet Metal.
So, counsel, I think we understand. I'm sure the facts of what happened here. Here's my question. I mean, a lot of the cases about piercing the corporate veil, including a reverse one, has to do with trying to collect a judgment, including that for the reverse, where someone who has a judgment against them tries to hide the assets in a subsequent corporation or something. And the question is whether you can go after the corporate assets in order to satisfy, an obligation of the shareholder. Or, when it was in the cases where it wasn't, where it was recognized here as like to let the shareholder take advantage of some benefit as against a creditor, right?
Right,
That's the Cargill case. So we're in I think what the district court is facing is not any of those situations. Like this situation, and I think as you described probably to start with, it's just unusual. We're in an unusual situation where the district court concluded after a trial on it that Mr. Perry entered into an agreement. He was the sole shareholder of Expert Metals. Expert Metals really wasn't functioning anymore. He understood when he entered into an agreement that he signed that Expert Metals owned the property, and yet he signed an agreement that was then incorporated within the J&D that the property belongs to Sheet Metal, and the district court, and then he gets the benefit of that agreement, everything that was incorporated in that mutual agreement relative to the dissolution of the marriage, and then later says, oh, no, Expert Metal owns that, Sheet Metal doesn't, and even though I knew about it when I entered into it, it belongs to Expert Mechanical. And the court is saying that just works in unfairness. And as sort of in the manifestation of my equitable power, I'm going to say no, as he was the alter ego of Expert Mechanical when he signed that agreement and got the benefit of it. And therefore, that constituted a transfer of that of the property from one entity to the other. What's wrong with that when we look at the factual findings here? I mean, it's not like other situations where other shareholders or creditors might be hurt, et cetera. I mean, it wasn't even a really going concern anymore.
I would agree that it's, I'd largely agree with your summary of the facts and that there is a problem here. The question is, how do you go about fixing it? And our perspective, and I think we said this to the district court, is there are other ways to address this problem. And really what should have happened is that it was a mistake and it should have been fixed within the 1 year prescribed by the state under 518.145 sub 2. That's the remedy.
Well, let me ask you this, Mr. Hansen. How is a legal remedy that has expired long before the respondent reasonably was aware of the defect in the stipulated dissolution judgment, how is that an adequate alternative basis for relief?
If your question is, how is it a, you know, is it fair, which I think is perhaps what you're getting at. I think that that's what the district court is grappling with, and the district court concluded that it was not fair. The question is, what do you do about it? And that's where I think we get problems here. You know, respectfully, to me, this is a case of bad facts potentially making bad law. The district court was troubled with the outcome here, and I understand why the district court was troubled by the outcome. The issue that I think this court has to grapple with is, what does that mean and what are we going to allow with regard to the corporate form? And my candid opinion is that if the court allows this to stand, this is a Pandora's box that the court really ought to think very carefully about before ratifying what the district court did. Because what the district court did was it took an asset from one corporation and put the asset into another corporation that was not even a party to the case. And respectfully, I think that the simple answer on this case is sheet metal isn't a part of this case. Case dismissed, no jurisdiction over the party. That's the simple answer. And I recognize that there is a fairness problem here.
You have to go back a second. Sheet metal is not a party here, you're saying. But I think what the district court is saying is, you know, irrespective of whether sheet metal is a party right now, and we'll leave that aside for a second, what did the J&D do?
It
decided equitably the J&D, by implementing the party's agreement, essentially effectuated the transfer that Mr. Perry agreed to. I'm not exactly sure why this 10 years later presence of sheet metal has to do with what happened at that time, which the court is saying equitably at that time a transfer was made. I think that's what the court's saying.
I did not read the district court decision that same way, Judge. I basically read the court's decision to be an acknowledgement that the parties, through mistake, believed that this asset belonged to sheet metal, and it did not. And now the district court is set about trying to fix that problem, and did so by moving an asset from one company to another company that was not part of an action. And so I think that it is problematic to say, well, sheet metal was going to be split between these two people, and so we'll just quit claim the property from this company to this company, and it'll flow down to the parties.
So what was needed to make sheet metal a party? I mean, the two shareholders were part of this action. Like, what are you saying? There was not jurisdiction because what didn't happen? There wasn't some other service that in the name of sheet metal on Mr. Perry? I mean, is that what you're saying?
Right. This happens all the time. You have a single member LLC and you sue the single member LLC shareholder corporate officer, and you sue the LLC. You send two complaints to the same address. One is the complaint for the company, and one is for the individual. Alternatively, it could have been done via the Secretary of State. The point that I think is important for this court to recognize is these corporate formalities are here for a reason. And we have these structures in place where a corporation's got to be served. It's got to appear via counsel. And I get that it's messy, but you know, respectfully, that's our job is to jump through the necessary hoops to make sure that the parties necessary to resolve the action are present. That didn't happen here.
Go ahead, Judge.
Well, if you have a follow-up, I was going to move back to a different legal question. So if you want to follow up, Judge Smith.
That's fine. Okay.
I want to go back to what you said in the beginning of your argument, Mr. Hansen, and that is that the only Minnesota case on point is a non-precedential opinion of this court rejecting application of a reverse piercing analysis under circumstances like this. Is it fair to say that that our Supreme Court has never definitively ruled out using such an approach to do equity in a case under circumstances like this?
Has the Minnesota Supreme Court ruled it out? I would say it has not. It has not addressed it.
So does this court have any role in terms of developing common law in a situation where our Supreme Court has not spoken?
Well, respectfully, I think I'd ultimately defer to your opinion on that, Judge Bjorkman, rather than mine. The Lawrence Leasing case presented that question, and the court rather emphatically said, this isn't Minnesota law, and we're not going here. And I believe that this court could properly follow the Lawrence Leasing precedent and say the same thing, and the mechanism for developing the law would then be a PFR to the Minnesota Supreme Court, and basically an argument that Minnesota should adopt this. I would go back to my point earlier, which is bad facts make bad law, and this case is substantially more of a mess than Lawrence Leasing. And I did not look to see whether or not there was a PFR filed in Lawrence Leasing. I don't know if my copy notes whether or not a PFR was sought, but this court had the opportunity to develop this doctrine if it so wanted and declined to do so in a case that was substantially cleaner than what we have here. Because I think that this jurisdiction problem that we've highlighted is a significant problem. The court has said, move this piece of real property from this company to this other company that is not part of the case.
Well, could I ask you this? It seems very clear that the judge here found that it was inequitable what occurred here. And the judge, as a judge would try to do, would try to use equitable principles to get the parties in the right place. And I think the findings on that are pretty strong about the inequities here. But I think we have case law, in fact, very strong case law, that when you're talking about courts of equity, and I just noticed one case, and I'll just quote it, the Prince versus Sunnyson, says, in equity, the kinds and forms of specific remedies for equity are as unlimited as the powers of such courts to shape relief awarded in accordance with the circumstances of the particular case. I mean, don't we have to view this in terms of what, the broad equitable powers of the court And I understand in this case, I mean, I understand your concern that you aren't having third outside parties basically ignoring the corporate structure. But this is a little different here because you're actually using the corporate laws, not as a shield, but as a weapon to basically your client is trying to get out of the agreement that was made as part of the dissolution. I mean, would this background allow us to expand how this case is viewed in these very strange circumstances under this limited fact scenario?
So a couple points there, Judge. Okay. One, I disagree that this is somehow being used as a sword rather than a shield. Secondly, I would agree that the broadly, equity is quite broad. The question that this case presents is what are the outer bounds of it? And I certainly would say that one of the outer bounds is you have to have a party there if you are purporting to affect relief as against that party. Ultimately, I think that what we are dealing with here is what are the proper limits of equity, because we go down a very perilous road if we simply keep repeating a mantra of equity and use that to utterly disregard multiple corporate forms. And that's what's purported to happen here. That's why this court has to reverse it. And the final point I would like to make is there were other tools available to the court. And we proposed that. We proposed a receiver for sheet metal, and that a receiver for sheet metal could have then presumptively stepped forward, recovered the piece of property, and effectuated the dissolution, if that's what the district court ultimately directed a receiver to do. There were other tools in the box, and the district court in this one reached for the most extreme one, and that's why this has to be reversed.
Could I ask a further follow-up question?
Of course.
I'm glad you went into that, because here the result was, I mean, you may disagree with what the judge did and how the judge got there, but the result was the judge said this expert sheet metal company is going into receivership. And I assume, I mean, do you disagree with that result?
No,
you may not like the reasoning how the court got there, but do you disagree with that result?
Not about expert sheet metal, but you got to have expert sheet metal at the table. And you're putting an asset into expert sheet metal. Expert sheet metal under our rules is a corporation, and you can't ignore that fact. And so putting a receiver there in place for expert sheet metal, empowered to go and obtain this asset, that's what should have happened, and it didn't. The court just said, move this piece of property from company A to company B, and it'll flow down to the shareholders.
May I ask one further question?
Sure.
All right. And as I understand the corporate dissolution law, that if in fact expert mechanical was dissolved as well, isn't the law that once it's dissolved, any assets remaining as a result of that dissolution is given to the shareholders? And in this case, the sole shareholder of Expert Mechanical would have been your client. Isn't that the way the law works?
It's been some time since I've looked at it, but I believe that the corporation, because it was dissolved, my understanding, administratively, that it can be revived for that limited purpose. And it's simply a filing and a payment of a fee with the Minnesota Secretary of State, and then the corporation springs back to life. So I do not believe that title has automatically passed to Douglas Perry in this case, and that's part of our problem.
Okay, and so we need a formal dissolution of Expert Mechanical as well.
You need a mechanism to pull the real property out of Expert Mechanical, yes.
All right. So if I had to summarize, the court can get to these results. It's just you don't like the reasoning that the court used.
Yes, it can get to this outcome, but it is opened a Pandora's box that this court should shut.
Okay. And may I ask one more question?
Of course.
Could we, as a court, indicate that while we may not accept the way the district court got there, basically utilize the law to say the court could have ended up there on another ground at the same result?
I believe that it would be appropriate for this court to reverse and remand. And if it chose to remand with instructions, that would be the prerogative of this court. I believe that it would be a mistake for this court, this appellate court, without all the facts to kind of say, district court, do this, because I think there are probably a few wrinkles in this that the district court is better suited to address.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Hansen, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court and counsel. My name is Ken Washey, and I represent the respondent in this case, Ms. Allison Perry. There's a couple of things that I would like to address during my presentation to the court. One of them relates to really what is the law regarding the piercing of the corporate liability shield doctrine. And then I would like to address some of the issues that the respondent included in their reply brief.
Can I begin with, if you don't mind, apropos of the first question with respect to piercing, I assume that just a general principle would have to be that there was no adequate remedy at law for the person seeking a piercing. Is that fair?
Actually, Your Honor, I don't think that that is the case. I know that the appellant's reply brief brought that issue up again. But when you look at the cases regarding equitable remedies and the requirement for an adequate remedy at law, none of those cases involves the application of the piercing doctrine. And I think why they don't, and why having an adequate remedy at law is not an element that the court necessarily needs to look at when deciding whether to apply that doctrine, is what the doctrine is itself. And I think it's relatively clear in Minnesota that the doctrine, the piercing doctrine, is the result of that is a court that says, stop. I'm not going to allow you to assert a corporate liability shield if you asserting that corporate liability shield is going to result in an inequitable decision or a fundamental unfairness. That's what the law is. And I think the law as to application of that piercing doctrine goes all the way back to the Clark's Will case that I've cited in my brief. What I'd like to do is kind of talk about the Ropke case, because I think that case
go ahead. But I do want to get back to the facts of this case, but you can go ahead and talk about that.
Okay. And Your Honor, what I want to mention and talk about in the Ropke case is that was what we can call a reverse piercing case. That was a 1981 Minnesota Supreme Court case where the Minnesota Supreme Court is addressing the piercing doctrine. And in that case, the court said that it was the concern in the case was application of the theory which the defendant characterized as a reverse pierce. And in that sentence, the Minnesota Supreme Court used quotation marks on the words reverse pierce in two different occasions. And I think why that's important, Your Honor, is because that demonstrates that the Minnesota Supreme Court doesn't necessarily put labels on the application of the piercing doctrine. And so when we looked at like the Lawrence Leasing case, that non-precedential case, that case decided to add a label to how it was that the district court in that case was applying the piercing doctrine. But I don't think that's appropriate because...
Well, I think it's just a descriptive. I mean, in one case, a regular piercing, you're trying to get at... Sorry, I have to make sure I have this right. There, you're trying to get at the shareholders... No, you're trying to get at the corporate assets, right, for a shareholder obligation. Whereas it's just descriptive to say that's not what you're doing. You're trying to do something else. Let me add, so I want to get back to, and I appreciate your answer to my question about adequate remedy at law. Let's leave aside whether it's required or not as a function of a court's exercise of its equitable authority. And let's just focus on what I think is the argument that there was a remedy, which is to correct the mistake that the court, district court here, concluded was in fact made, and that was a factual finding, might have even been in summary judgment, that I can't remember which one, but it's undisputed that there was a mistake made when it describes the ownership of 30 Main Street. And I think here, as I understand it, like the MTA was in August of 2010, the J&D was December of 2010. And then I think the undisputed facts or the facts are that the sheet metal failed in 2010, it must have failed like very quickly. And then by October of 2011, Ms. Perry is going to family court to, bring in action in family court. So within that year, within a year, there was already dispute about the property. I think that was at issue there. I know that the case didn't go forward for failing to mediate. I just don't really understand why that wasn't a time when this could have been addressed to correct what was an error in the J&D, that there was time to do that. I know now, in 2019, it comes back up and under a different framework, but why wasn't that addressable then?
Your Honor, I think that's a very good question. And as the court noted, whether or not there's an adequate remedy at law, I don't believe that is an element that the court needs to look at when applying the doctrine. But as it relates to this case, Your Honor, and again, going back to what the law is and what the result of the law is Mr. Perry did not raise that shield at that time. And so that post-decree litigation over child support and over a buyout of the assets, never did Mr. Perry raise that defense. So Ms. Perry had no reason to think that Mr. Perry was going to raise a corporate liability shield defense during that time frame. And so
is it a defense or is it just simply that is a factual mistake, which I think the district court, I think that the underlying, what this case is about there was a mistake in the MTA and the J&D, and the district court here said that mistake by recognizing that, there's an unfairness that's rendered because of it. And I'm going to not correct the mistake, but I'm just going to apply equitable principles to change matters such that an unfairness isn't worked. But a mistake seemed resolvable under, and I know sometimes time limits are an unhappy reality. They bring finality to things by having a time limit, even if it turns out, oh shoot, I wish I hadn't blown that time limit, And it's just, I just don't really see why that doesn't play a role here. Why should it be corrected effectively later when there's a mechanism for correcting a mistake that could have been and should have been addressed earlier at a time period when the parties were at odds and the sheet metal had already ceased to function? Sheet metal, had already gone down.
Yes, Your Honor. Firstly, I would say that the district court certainly did make a determination that a mistake had been made. I would argue that the parties themselves, the way they dealt with each other and the way that they dealt with the assets that are involved, they didn't really think they made a mistake. And I think that you can look at when was Douglas Perry and Expert Mechanical, when were they an alter ego? And I think at the point in time when they came to their agreement in August of 2010, Douglas Perry and Expert Mechanical Inc. were alter egos. And at that point in time, because that's what the facts were, and that's how the parties dealt with each other, at that point in time when he signed that agreement, it effectively transferred the property. And so that would be one way that I would say that the court can look at it and say, well, there really wasn't a mistake if the parties didn't believe they made a mistake. And
except the corporation wasn't a party to that agreement. I mean, how can you bind a corporation and say there was a conveyance of property when the corporation isn't even a party.
Exactly, Your Honor. And the way that you do that is by you don't allow somebody to raise that piercing the liability shield through the use of the piercing doctrine.
Well, okay. So you're basically arguing, I mean, if I hear you correctly, you're arguing equitable estoppel.
Your Honor, I'm arguing that the court has the power to use the piercing doctrine to stop Mr. Perry from raising the liability shield that Your Honor pointed out, because factually that is correct, that Expert Mechanical Inc. was not a party to the divorce case. That is factually correct. But Minnesota, going back more than 50 years, has recognized that the court has the power to step in and say, stop, I'm not going to let you use that fact when there's going to be a fundamental unfairness. And in this
Can I ask you this? Is putting corporations into receivership, is that an equitable remedy that can be utilized by a court when you have?
Your Honor, I believe that the court, I haven't looked that issue up. I believe a court would have that equitable power, but I also believe that it's part of the Minnesota statutes as it relates to what the court can do during a winding up process.
I'm just looking at the statute here. It says, and the court cites to this, the court may grant any equitable relief it deems just and reasonable in the circumstances, or may dissolve a corporation and liquidate its assets and businesses. I mean, in this case, I mean, we have clearly an inequity, and why wouldn't just putting both corporations into receivership solve these issues? And then the court can do whatever equity it wants to vis-a-vis the two corporations.
Your Honor, I certainly think that that would be another remedy that the district court could look at. And I think from our perspective, and I know that Your Honor's noticed this, our theory of the case is a little bit different than what the district court decided. Our theory of the case is that the agreement in 2010 and the divorce judgment actually acted to transfer interests of the real estate and the personal property to my client personally. I think that based on the terms set out in those two agreements, that's what the effect was. And that's the way that my client's complaint is framed. And that's the same argument that we have maintained throughout this entire litigation. However, the judge's method of equitably resolving this really results in the same thing. And so that's why my client hasn't.
And I'm going to ask you the same question I asked the appellant. Are we bound to the reasoning of the court? I mean, if in fact if we all agree the result is correct, that the company should be put into receivership and dissolved, if we agree on that, can we, as a appellate reviewing court, say we disagree with the reasoning to get there, but we think that the statutes are broad enough to allow equity to be done within the realm of a receivership?
Your Honor, it's my position that I absolutely believe that Your Honors can do that. I believe I cited in my brief the case law, which gives the court the power to uphold a district court's decision, but under a different reason.
But in appellate courts, we don't do equity. I mean, that's a district court function, isn't it? I mean, that's how I understand it. Am I wrong about that?
Your Honor, I don't believe that you're wrong about it. No, I think that is accurate, that the district court is, in the first instance, a court that can use its equitable powers. But then I think the appeals court, when it's reviewing a district court's application of its equitable powers, can say, well, we don't necessarily think that the court utilized its equitable powers properly in this case for this reason, but we do think that its equitable power to order that result for this reason is appropriate.
Well, the question here is, I think, ultimately is, sheet metal was jointly given to the parties 50-50. There's a want to dissolve sheet metal. What does sheet metal own such that it can be divided 50-50? I mean, so even if it's in receivership or it's dissolution, whatever, we still got to figure out, well, what does sheet metal own such that it be given to the parties? Now, I understand your theory of the case is that it went directly to your client. That's not what the district court found here in interpreting the J&D, that instead it went to sheet metal. And here's, I don't know what my question is exactly, but there's sort of, there will be a question. I'll put it that way. Both in the MTA, in the J&D, in the way this case is, in the way the parties behaved, in a way then this case was litigated, there's so much not adherence to sort of corporate and other realities between individuals and corporations. Okay, so even the J&D is confusing. It needed to be interpreted in terms of like individual versus corporate, et cetera. But now we get here, and then there has to be two corporate. I guess one, you know, it's ignoring the corporate existence, or like deciding as a matter of equity that the corporate existence should be ignored with respect to Expert Mechanical. And then we get to the sheet metal question, which I think actually, and I want Mr. Hansen to address this in rebuttal. The idea is, oh, well, we shouldn't do that because sheet metal wasn't served here or wasn't present here. I'm not really seeing that as being like one thing following the other, but I will ask you, Mr. Washi, I'm sorry, I'm not pronouncing your name right. What about the fact that sheet metal was not served and then was it a party to this litigation? Did it have to be? Is that a fundamental problem for your client?
Your Honor, it's our position that that is not a fundamental problem for our client. The respondent served their answer and counterclaim February 22nd of 2019. On February 27th of 2019, the respondent and
but respondent counsel, isn't sheet metal. The question is whether sheet metal needed to be served.
Right. And Your Honor, from our perspective, they have waived that argument. They have waived that jurisdictional argument, and they've waived it because they have not asserted it in a timely fashion. And they served an initial answer in February of 2019. They served affidavits in February of 2019. They served a first amended answer.
Right. I appreciate that. And the question, I guess, is a non-party usually can't waive another. I mean, one party can't waive another non-party's rights. And then the question is there some reason that non-service can be ignored because, for example, both shareholders are present or something like that? I don't really see the waiver analysis working personally myself, not
speaking. Your Honor, as is set out in the district court's order, all shareholders of Expert Sheet Metal and Expert Mechanical were all parties to this litigation. And so from our perspective, the court did have and does have jurisdiction over Expert Sheet Metal Inc. That I believe that is relatively clear. Both based on the waiver argument and based on the fact that all shareholders for that entity were present.
Do any of the panel members, I know we took extra time with Mr. Hansen, so I don't want to
I have
your time. So go ahead, Judge Wooten.
I think if I look at the conclusions of law here, the judge did send and the parties agreed that Expert Sheet Metal should be wound up and dissolved. So I think that was an agreement on that. But there's no mention of Expert Mechanical here. And I know that that so we only have one of the companies that's being dissolved. In that, this is the result. Does this result really satisfy your attempts to get everything cleaned up without Expert Mechanical in there, so that this result is won't be sufficient anyway?
And Your Honor, assuming that question is towards me, because I know that my time has expired.
Yes, it is.
In concert with the district court's determination that Expert Sheet Metal Inc. owns the real estate and owns the personal property that were transferred in 2010, then that would end up with the result that my client is seeking.
But assume we adopt the argument of the appellant that a dissolution court cannot convey property from a third party that isn't part of the agreement. If we accept that, then this result will not. I mean, will this result get you to the same place, even if you only have one of the companies in there and not the actual company that owns this property, according to the deed that's on file?
And Your Honor, that's a very good question. And the answer is no. If this court allows Mr. Perry to assert the defense of the corporate liability shield, then it would not have the result that my client is requesting. My client's result that it requested to the Superior Court, the District Court, is that the District Court say stop to Mr. Perry. We are not going to allow you to assert the corporate liability shield. We're going to apply the piercing doctrine.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Counsel for appellant, 5 minutes rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Ultimately, I think my opponent's argument establishes why there are issues here, that equity cannot be absolutely unlimited. And our case law sets boundaries. And the question here is whether or not the court passed those boundaries. And I would say it definitely did. I think taken to its logical conclusion, my opponent's argument is that, the court has the equitable authority regardless of things like 518.245, or I'm sorry, 145. There was a year to fix this mistake, but equity demands that we fix it because it's a problem. And that simply is not my conception of the way our courts operate. There are boundaries on equity, and I think that the appropriate answer here is that we have run up against one of those boundaries. And one of the points that Your Honor made, Judge Smith, was it's pretty routine for lawyers, for courts to say you had a remedy. There was a time limit to do it, and that remedy is now gone. That is the whole point of statutes and limitations. And
Mr. Hanson, let me ask you this. I mean, if this had been brought in the dissolution file, for example, and the argument had been advanced that your client knew well and good which corporate entity owned that real estate and participated in presenting an MTA to the court that was exactly wrong on that point. I mean, isn't there an argument that the district court in the dissolution context would be able to do equity, saying that that representation to the court was made fraudulently and thus suspending the 1 year statute of limitations? I mean, would that be in your mind the only way that equity could come into play in this under these circumstances? And I'm not suggesting your client did commit a fraud upon the court, but I'm just saying, is your argument that the equity, if at all, had to be exercised in connection with the dissolution judgment?
I believe it did have to be exercised with the dissolution judgment. I think that even if that I don't think you can avoid the cutoff of 518.14 simply by concluding that it was done as a fraud on the court. Regardless, that's not our record. Judge Smith, you had indicated there was a question you wanted me to respond to. I'm not sure if I've done so to your satisfaction.
Right. I mean, it was more about, you seem to join two things to me, which is don't do an outsider reverse piercing here because sheet metal wasn't served. I don't really understand what sheet metal and its corporate existence with respect to service really has to do with whether that doctrine should be employed. And then I guess, is there any case law for or against the proposition that when both shareholders are in fact parties to a litigation, that the jointly owned corporation is not itself present there sufficiently to do this, to transfer property to it?
Let me start with the second of those two. And I don't have a specific case, but I will just say in general, reading corporation, our statutes on corporations, corporations are a creature of statute, and shareholders do not equal a corporation, which goes back to the point that I was attempting to make on the service. All the time, we serve a single member corporation. You send two copies of the complaint, you have two affidavits of service. That is our system with regard to corporate entities. And there are good public policy and statutory reasons for that. We've decided to grant them some sort of status akin to personship. And for purposes of our courts, there is a notice requirement that simply was not satisfied here. To your point about, does it matter for outside peers? I would say under the factual circumstances here, it does, simply because the district court is saying, take this real property from Corporation A to Corporation B, and Corporation B isn't here. And I think that we just do too much violence to our corporate forms to say, we're not going to care that sheet metal isn't actually here. We're just going to divide it down to the shareholders. These rules are in place for a reason.
Great. Thank you. Thank you both very much for the extra time you gave us today in response to our questioning. And the case is submitted.